Good afternoon. Hope you all had a decent lunch. Somebody said nutritious lunch. I heard somebody say that. We will spend most of the afternoon speaking about conceptual framework, at least for the next 2 hours. Then we will talk about the post-implementation review. I think April is back, or Mariela is back. Then disclosure initiative in the materiality, and I'm sure Alan and Christy and Amy will be here for that. So without much wastage of time, let's dive into conceptual framework, and Joanne begin to tease us.
Right, good afternoon. Well, the next two sessions, Christy and I are going to cover two of the methods that the ISD is seeking to address in its conceptual framework project. Before getting on to discuss these, I'd just like to emphasize a couple of points about the project as a whole. And in Agenda Paper 5, page 3 just summarizes a little bit about the project. First of all, just to emphasize that the project isn't a fundamental rethink. It's not the initial to rewrite a new conceptual framework. It's generally working well, but there are areas of weakness that are causing problems for the ISD developing new standards. So the aim is to address these weaknesses, filling in gaps, updating and improving the existing guidance. And the ISD is still at quite an early stage in this process. It's issued a discussion paper in July, just discussing a variety of ideas and setting out some preliminary views. And we're asking for comments by the 14th of July. Now, the preliminary views are likely to change, and even when they are finalised in the new conceptual framework, this won't automatically change the requirements of existing standards, because the new framework won't override existing standards, and any decision to amend an existing IFRS as a consequence of changes to the framework would be a separate project requiring the normal due process step. So as I said, today Christy and I are going to focus on two of the matters covered in the discussion paper. And I'm going to start with the problem that arises in relation to the definition of a liability, specifically what we mean by present obligation in circumstances when an entity, well, any requirement to transfer a future resource remains conditional on the entity's future actions, and these are actions that the entity could, at least in theory, avoid. So examples might be exceeding a threshold, or retaining employees until they meet vesting conditions, or operating in a specific market on a future date. And in the absence of guidance in the conceptual framework at the moment, existing standards take different approaches. And on page 4 of this paper, I set out how the approaches can differ in different standards. So if you take IS 37, for example, to start with, and its interpretation, IFRIC 21 on levies, often the levies are calculated by reference to the entity's past revenues or some other past measures of activity.
Do you mind if I could just make, before we get into detail, I
yes.
think comment about the, perhaps short one, please. I think, first of all, at least from my perspective, I welcome the fact that you are trying to move forward on the conceptual framework. You know, there's different views, but I think you've come out with a very comprehensive document. So, personally, I would support you trying to move forward. I understand that was actually something that was a wish of your, when you were consulted on the agenda, that you, that was as a consequence of that. Just one point that struck me a little bit strange, if I understand it right, is that you're saying that new standards generally should be in line with conceptual framework that may deviate. Of course, I find that strange. How can you, I mean, I can understand that as you develop new standards, you might hit issues that are not thought about in conceptual framework, but I don't see how long term you can have standards out there that are not fully aligned with the conceptual framework. So to my mind, if you hit an issue, it means you've got to go back and start with the conceptual framework. So can you just give me your views on that?
Yeah, maybe I'll say a couple of words about that. And I think the debate here is between two views. One is that the framework should be a sort of unbreakable constitution, which has to cover everything, and you can't issue a standard that conflicts with it. If you discover some area where you think the framework's not working, your first step should be to amend the framework before you go ahead and issue a standard, which is in a way I think what you're saying, Malcolm. The other view is that the framework's never going to be perfect, you're never going to be able to cover every eventuality, and that you also leave some flexibility there to deal with cases where it doesn't quite work. And you wouldn't want that to happen in every project, because otherwise it wouldn't be a certain amount of service. But there might be the occasional case when you find you need to depart from it. What we suggested in the discussion paper was that if the board does depart, it can only be to meet the higher level objective of providing useful information to users. And so that would be a case where you've got some detailed requirements and something that doesn't work in that particular instance.
I think my point was, Peter, I'm not saying you can't have a standard that conflicts with the existing frame. I mean, I agree, you might hit, when you're developing a new standard, you might hit something that hasn't been thought about in the conceptual framework. But I would have welcomed, I think, a commitment if you get into that situation, that by you can come out with a standard that doesn't comply with the current framework, but that should then mean you have to make a commitment to go back and fix the framework on that particular point.
Hello, so if you do that comply, then you want to decide something like that.
Again, on that, I think it maybe is more a compliant, but I think that's a very good characterization of what the discussion paper envisaged. But Malcolm, there may also be a time when the board decides not to comply with the framework. Because, for example, it may decide that complying with the framework would require something that overall we hear is not cost beneficial. So that may be the explanation of why, in this instance, you know, for a specific requirement, I'm not talking about the standard as a whole, but within the standard, why we might say, well, the standard would require recognition to take the complexity, et cetera, or, you know, measurements on a basis that's consistent, which doesn't pass the cost-benefit test. And so, as Peter said, that's the time when we might explain it. And I think I might take your challenge to us as being, if you have to deviate from the framework, think about whether it signals that the framework needs revision rather than you automatically have to.
Well, that's fine.
That. Yeah. Because there may be someone who said, clear with the framework, you know, it's clear the framework sends you in this direction, but everything we've heard is it just isn't worth doing that. We're going to do Y instead, and we'll explain in the basis why we're deviating from the framework.
Also, as Peter said, the threshold is pretty high. It's not that every day you can change it. I don't think that is the intention. It is sort of one of rare instances where I think you're right. You need to think about that time whether conceptual framework needs to be amended because of that, or is it, like Mary said, cost-benefit analysis? We need to think about it. But it's not an automatic one-way route.
Stop and say this is a signal of weakness.
Just a question. When these objectives were set, to respond to the gender consultation? I mean, because of the gender consultation, these specific objectives were established. Because when we responded to that consultation, we also requested a revision of the framework. As prepared, the framework could help us understand a lot of the reasons why the reasons the way they are. But addressing very specific and narrow issues and problems, I don't know if that helps us much. So that's why I'm making that question. Is it intended to revise the public consultation?
The responses to the gender consultation said that we ought to continue our work on the framework and complete work on the framework. And I think that the choice the board had was between starting from zero, spending a long time, and eventually developing a revised framework after 5, 10, 15 years, whatever. Or taking the existing starting point and trying to fill in the gaps and maybe make a few improvements. And our perception was that most of the time the framework's been working quite well and it's helping us produce good standards. So we thought that starting from scratch wasn't really going to be the most useful approach. And it was best to try and concentrate the efforts on making improvements and filling in gaps rather than starting again from the beginning. So I don't think that decision to set the scope in that way was driven directly by the responses to the consultation. I think that's probably more the board's judgment of where it can make the get the best value for money out of the project.
Sorry, John. Go ahead,
then. Okay, so if we go back to these obligations that are conditional on the entity direction, and on page 4, you see the differences between the application and different standards. With IAS 37, it requires that all the obligations existing independently of an entity direction are recognised. And that means that nothing is recognised as a liability if it remains conditional at all on the entity future action. And then in IAS 34, the interim financial statement standard, it takes a slightly different approach because, amongst other things, it covers lease payments and as a contingent on an entity exceeding an annual sales threshold. And it requires the entity to accrue a liability as progress is made towards the threshold if the entity expects to exceed it. And the rationale given in that standard is that in such situations, the entity has no realistic alternative but to make the future payments. And then, yet another principle, I think in IAS 19, the employee benefits standard, which addresses profit sharing and bonus payments that relate to past service but are also conditional on future employment. And it takes the approach that the liability is always recognised despite the conditions as employees render the service that increases the amount to be paid. So the vesting, the achievement of the conditions isn't taken into consideration as the identification of the liability at all. It's taken into consideration at the stage of measuring it. So we've got these differences in approaches and different standards. What the IAS is hoping to do is to develop a principle in the conceptual framework that it could use as the basis for developing IFRSs in future. And the discussion paper sets out three different views on what that approach might be. But before we get to them, I'd like to emphasise something that all of these approaches have in common, and that's explained on page 5. The thing that they have in common with each other and with existing standards is that all of them would require that the definition of a liability must have arisen in the obligation as a result of past events, and by which we mean that the amount of the future transfer will be determined by reference to the benefits of these or other activities conducted by the entity before the end of the reporting date. And these activities could be making sales, earning profits, or even just operating in a particular market. But the important thing is that the amount of the liability, the amount of the future transfer, will be determined by reference to these events that must have happened before the end of the reporting period. And this is an important common feature of all of the approaches because it means that it will stop liabilities being identified for future operating expenses, such as future salaries and that sort of thing. And that will be the case whatever view is taken and whichever approach is taken with regard to the remaining conditions. And then that brings us on to the question is this past event sufficient to create the present obligation if it remains conditional on the entity's future action? And this is where there are three different views covered in the discussion paper. And they're summarised on page 6 of the paper. So the first view is that this past event isn't sufficient on its own. It has the liability must also be strictly unconditional. In other words, there's absolutely nothing the entity could do to avoid the future transfer. And in some ways, this approach is a bit like that in IAS 37. The second view, I think, is similar to the first view, and it also requires the obligation to be unconditional. But instead of requiring it to be strictly unconditional, it requires it to be practically unconditional. And by this we mean that although the entity might in theory be able to avoid the future transfer, it doesn't have the practical ability to do so. Perhaps because to avoid it, it would have to cease operating as a going firm, or leave a specific market, or somehow severely curtail its operations. So in a way, it's a bit like the approach in IAS 34, which recognises the liability. There's no realistic alternative for settling it. And then the third view, I think, is quite different from the first two. In this applying this third view, it applies an approach that the past event alone is sufficient to give rise to a present obligation if there is an obligation that is either unconditional or conditional on the entity's future actions. The theory there is that either way, that the entity no longer has complete discretion to avoid future transfer. And on taking the further actions, it will have to make some sort of payment that it wouldn't have had to make in the absence of the past event. So the effect is that the entity recognises in each period all of the costs that it expects to have to pay in relation to the benefits received in that period. Page 7 has a simple example. On the 1st of April each year, and it's 1% of the revenue calculated in the previous calendar year. And here we've got an entity that's preparing its financial statements at the end of December and needs to decide whether it has an obligation to pay that levy, even though it is yet to satisfy the final conditions. On page 8, to set out how you would go about applying these 1, 2, and 3 to that particular example. And in all of these, we say that yes, there has been a past event. The past event is the earning of the revenues on which the levy will be calculated. And then there is another step to applying each of the views. And the view one you have to ask is it strictly unconditional? And the answer is no, it's not strictly unconditional. It's conditional on the entity building on the market in April. So view 1 would not identify a liability. At the other extreme, view 3, the only thing that's necessary is the past event. There is a conditional obligation arising from a past event, so yes, there is a liability. View 2 is the one that may or may not produce a liability, because the first step is there a past event, yes. The second step is it practically unconditional? And in each case, the entity would have to make adjustments as to whether it has the practical ability to avoid the liability. The example that I've chosen on page 7, I think it's highly likely that it would say it doesn't have the practical ability to avoid this obligation. So in this example, there would be a liability recognised, and it would be the just like the increase, so the practical consequences are like the same as the increase. The sort of instance where you might end up with a different answer would be where if the entity has the practical ability to avoid the obligation. Now, when might that happen? Possibly, if it's making progress, if the final condition is reaching a threshold of some sort, and it thinks that it's making its way towards the threshold, but could be something to actually avoid using that threshold. In use two, it wouldn't recognize a liability. In use three, it would recognize, it would identify a liability to pay. It might measure it as a very small amount if it thinks it's not going to hit the threshold, but it would identify a liability.
Thank you. Joan, can I come in on that and be bold and test my further thinking about this, because Olivia, the question you've asked is one that we've had a lot. What's the real difference between U2 and U3? How does it differ? And as I've thought about trying to respond to that, I think U2 says practically unconditional means kind of, you know, major forces say you can't avoid it. And by that, the example that Joan gave is inconsistent with the going concern. So shut your business. If you're an airline, you can't avoid the overhaul cost without stopping to fly the only plane you have. You know, that kind of thing. As opposed to, you know, Joan's threshold example in view three, where it is much more, you know, you don't have to stop a whole area of activity or stop a business or cease being a going concern to avoid it, which is more the anchor of the test in two. Is, you know, do you push to make that extra 100,000 of sales if that extra 100,000 of sales will put you into a new tax bracket? Kind of thing. It's not a tax standard. To be clear, I should never use the tax as an example, but that, you know, that notion where you could, I think, while still within your going concern assumption, make a decision about whether or not to take the step that crystallizes that last action, where two says more the way you avoid it might raise into question some aspects of going concern.
Thank you. So I asked another question on U1, but I don't know if Mary maybe has answered that clearly. How do you link U1 with the going concern issue? Because if maybe, you know, April 1st, you know, my liability arises on April 1st, but I'm closing the books on December 31st. So if, you know, if I continue my business, by definition, I will have to pay this liability. So how do you link it with, you know, the accounting principle you use to close your books?
I think what I was actually just going to finish with was, on page 9, I've put a cross through V1, and I've done that because I think you've used sort of chimes with that of a lot of people, and although the IFC hasn't reached a firm view on one of these approaches, it has tentatively rejected V1. For the sort of reasons, it doesn't think that you should admit from your financial statements liability for reasons to tough activities and that you have no tax choice ability to avoid if you chose to use this instrument. Yes?
And I'm going to ask Kevin, and then Bob, do you still want to talk? Or?
Sure.
Kevin?
Yeah. Part of mine is how to rationalize it through with current consolidation period. So, you know, I'm in mining, so I've got exploration activities in the country where I may or may not be the only shareholder. As a consequence of exploration activities, I have to do rehabilitation. But I can practically avoid in that I can send the money off into its horizon, because it's not revenue generating, it's only an expense incurring subsidiary. So I can cut the expenses, don't liquidate, and make them with the quickly. It's how you can get what consolidation theory at the moment says that I bring, even though that exploration entity is insolvent, I bring it through to the group consolidation. This would seem to say, well, because cutting it off from your business is losing nothing, that you could, my principal said, this is a steady place. No revenue loss, only upside, no more expenses. That seems to then cap my liability recognition, which doesn't, I know it might feature into this contractual world that we live in, but there's this moral obligation as well that you're not going to do that. And it's how you, it seems to be very contractually based as opposed to business common sense based.
If you have the practical ability to do that, why don't you?
Because it's a bad press.
Right, well, maybe.
You live with it, but it's a bad press.
You don't have the best practical ability then.
Yeah, no. We've just done it. We've announced that we're cutting from 20 exploration countries down to 3. You know, that's what we did as part of the change in the gold price. We've cut from 3, and we've set them adrift. It seems that, you know, should I be capping something because I do have the practical ability? Whereas there's other decisions that are greater than necessarily the practical ability.
Is Kevin's question the kind of question we might be sort of standard level looking at consolidation in the context? And so if this were finalized as a new conceptual framework, then say, okay, here's the question about what I've labeled as in substance defeasance. You know, is then when we're trying to debate standard say, okay, how does the whatever view emerges as the final in the conceptual framework drive our reasoning on that? But I think that's something we'd answer more at a standard level than in the conceptual framework.
I think you settled a lot of it. I'm on that page. It's something like that. I think of an example which is going to happen actually, so it's not talking. We treat IFRS 6 expense. The Colombian government says that IFRS 6 expense is wrong and insists on IFRS 6 capitalized. And they make us pay income tax based on our status of our shareholder equity, which of course is really capitalized. It'll be a humongous number. We're not mining anything in Colombia. And so we're in legal debate with them at the moment. But if we lose, there's no way that entity has the resources to meet that liability. So it's like, how do I measure that contingent liability today? Well, I think it's possible. It's not possible. It's the one you don't put in the book. So we've got full disclosure of the contingent liabilities, but if I lose this case, we're still fixed. There's no way they're going to collect $190 million for an entity that I'm expecting at the moment. It's just not going to happen. And that's not moral obligation, it's a tax one. And the tax contingencies are not enforceable anywhere in the world. So, how do you measure this real liability to shareholders? Is this thing to say, well, you could walk away from it, and there's no penalty because it's not, you've got no moral obligation.
So are you leaning towards more towards view 3 then?
No, I'm leaning more towards view 2. But it's having you, I can see that there's a capping issue, and that capping issue doesn't seem to fit current consolidation theory. That you would have an obligation in the subsidiary that gets eliminated on consolidation to a lower number. And that's not the way consolidation theory works at the moment. It's a pure flow for it. And this would say I'd end up two different numbers if I consolidated. Great, it might be the right answer, but it's not the way we think it does.
Bob?
I like where you're going with this, and just, I guess it'll be part of your discussion of how much this will help you. If I look at view 3, and I look at the second bullet, it says maybe either unconditional or conditional. So it's either or, if you can throw out that bullet and just say, around past events, whatever your definition of past events. And I think you too, and I was drawn to that, but you know, it's practically unconditional and just have to go with the going concern. And what's not a great answer to me, I don't think, although maybe one of you two, is let's say decommissioning costs. And let's say you have 5 plants, each of them would have decommissioning costs. But I can sell one of the plants, and that would be a practicality, I think, that I can get out of that obligation. I'll just sell it, maybe recognize that obligation part of it on the gain or loss. But I have an entity with 1 plant, and that's my whole source of revenue, you know, look at going concern, I may not be able to get out of that just on a going concern basis. So kind of you get different answers for maybe a fact pattern where you don't think there should be different fact patterns, that larger companies that have diverse businesses would not be reporting liabilities versus smaller companies that have a single person. And so that kind of troubles me. And just making a comment, really, it's only going to get a perfect answer, but that starts getting into view three, which seems too encompassing, but maybe view three is the proper way to think about it, because maybe just put up where you have an issue, possibly, view two, which is based on the difference in the way a company operates.
Rizzo?
I wanted to express an opinion from the three options here. What would make sense to me would be option one, view one. This could provide some symmetry between the recognition of assets and liabilities. I mean, assets you have an asset when you control the resource, and you have a liability when you don't control the outflow of the resource. So going to view two or view three unavoidably produces an imbalance between assets and liabilities. And I honestly couldn't see a good explanation in the discussion paper, neither for view two or view three. It seems to me that this practically unconditional has to, although the words were not used, something to do with economic compulsion. Although I saw in the discussion paper that constructive obligations doesn't necessarily mean economic compulsion, I couldn't understand the logic behind that explanation. But I can almost say, for me, it would only make sense if it had something to do with economic compulsion, not only going concerns, but it's too extreme. And I might be wrong, but I have a perception that this would only work due to or due to if exorbitory contracts are understood the way the discussion paper describes them. Something that you have an assessment liability that nets itself and produces zero result, zero recognition. But I also don't agree with that view. I mean, if you don't have control over a resource, how could you have net asset or net liability, which is the result of the combination of an asset liability, but you don't control the asset? So if you don't have that situation, then you would always have obligations being recognized because you wouldn't have the netting effect. I don't know if I made myself clear in this last part.
I think you are making yourself clear. I think what we're saying with executory contracts is, yes, you can see the contracts have established rights and obligations, but it's more of an obligation to exchange something at one resource for another resource, and that's the reasoning for measuring them net. It is necessary to apply that to the executive contract account in the way that we do at the moment. So these use two and three to work.
You have any follow-up on this one?
Yeah, for instance, suppose you hire a service and you don't get to control anything. I mean, you have probably the obligation to exchange when you receive the outcome of that service. But if you go with view three here, it is conditional. So only if you say that you have sales.
It's to the past event, right?
But you have the finance. Find a contract. That's not the thing that drives the
decision. Your question is the act of finding a contract attached to that?
Yeah.
I think the act of signing a contract is an event that gives rise to this right and obligation to exchange. It's not yet the obligation to transfer a resource. That will come if the other party performs their side. So if you receive one half of the exchange, you receive your basis, whatever you have the right to receive, that then creates the obligation to pay. That's what it changes from the executive right and obligation to exchange into an obligation to transfer the resource.
Okay.
So the signing of the contract is an event, but it's an event that
only beginning of the event.
The right and obligation to exchange.
I might be wrong.
Can I just comment on U1 real quick? Is that it has pretty draconian results if you follow it, I believe. That the one example would be stock-based compensation, that you wouldn't record anything until the vesting actually occurred. And I take it a step further and see if you agree with this, but you wouldn't record legal contingencies, so you have to have a court case against you where it was totally unconditional that you had to pay. So U1, although if you're arguing for symmetry, you have awfully draconian results for the way we account for things nowadays. Is that correct?
It is correct that it would be quite a narrow view of an obligation, so it would omit compensation subject to vesting conditions. I think court cases are slightly different in that the way that we describe court cases is that the past event that created the obligation is your act of wrongdoing. And all that the court case is going to do is to confirm whether a liability actually existed. It's a slightly different situation, so I don't think it would knock out court cases.
Oh, no. Because the wrongdoing sounds like conditional
No,
That's an assessment, though.
It depends on how you view these obligations. I don't think that U1 would necessarily knock out court cases, but it would knock out some
Yes, remember here that when we say conditional, we're only talking about things that are conditional on your future actions. We're not talking about things that are conditional on some outside event, such as the court decision or the level of an index or whether something else occurs. Purely the ones that you can avoid, that are conditional on your action. But you're right about the vesting case. I mean, if you want to work out
the word of story, the other one is that you could just not defend yourself. It's a choice you made.
Yeah, I think for me personally, U1 will not give decision usefulness because it will reduce the information content. For example, the December 31st, you are in existence, but if you are in existence on January 1st, you will have a levy on it. Now the levy, the District 21 says that you don't need to recognize anything. And how is it possible? You're closing your books on December 31st, and if you are around on January 1st, you will have to pay levy. How is that you don't recognize anything on December 31st? Is that right?
The first January, because if you are still there on the 31 of December, you are still there at the first of January,
Okay,
Hiroshi? I'm not supposed to be one because it's too story of the family. I generally support you two because it is consistent with most of the accounting practices of IFRS. But the account pension accounting consistent with U3. So I think we can develop a concept to both consistent with U2 and U3. It's very good, but compared with the discussion of other sections, this discussion seems to be too specific for conceptual framework. It might be good to just give a general discussion in a conceptual framework and then delegate most of all of the discussion to standard level. That's my view.
It's worth commenting that the examples and the details G1, 2, 3 are only in the discussion paper to help people work through what the consequences of the different things are. I think in the end what we picture would be in the actual conceptual framework would maybe be a paragraph that has pretty much only what you see in any one of the views. It would not go on and say, therefore you do this or you don't do that. It would just be the conclusion reached. Mm-hmm. And you're right, the examples would all be done at the standard level.
Mm-hmm.
My comment was the same as to give several kind of examples, not to have just a few ones that are very evident. Maybe it should be good idea to more complicated example.
Yeah, I was wanting to pick up on what Olivia said, and now for the pre-discussion this morning, we kicked around a few other ideas, which I'm now looking at what you'd like to go from here. So you tell us in the paper that I'm coming to with employee presence today, or all of that, they started to be saying continued consideration, but we were thinking things like, building provisions for renovations, or making good, damaged mines. Is that under a contract perhaps? So we were thinking, perhaps you have thought that too, but there must be a lot of other scenarios that would be interesting to explore.
I think we would be exploring them all at the standards level once we complete the conceptual framework. We would not be trying to answer any of them in the conceptual framework itself. We just wanted to include those so people understood understood what the implications were.
Yeah.
Just like the waiting past the time. So if you have anything else to say or don't, or you can complete it. I'm just saying that.
No, it's okay. I'll take the point back. In example, the reason I took the one in this case is that once when the ISP has had problems deciding what the ISP is, but I accept there are others as well.
Anything else on this?